Welcome to Great Australian Lives.
For Tobin Brothers Funerals,
celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight has a remarkable story to share with you. As a clinical and forensic psychologist who worked in the prison system, he came face to face with not only some of Australia's most reviled criminals, but many people whose lives had been destroyed by violence and trauma. After a stress-induced stroke forced him to dramatically rethink his career, he embarked on an incredible journey to heal himself and retrain his brain after losing much of his sensory capabilities. He's now an expert in post-traumatic growth, and his latest book, The Power of Suffering, is a collection of stories about how people have grown kinder and stronger in the wake of tragedy and trauma. It is my pleasure to welcome David Rowland to Great Australian Lives. How are you, David?
I'm fantastic. Good to be with you, Laura.
Good to be with you too. Now, I'm most of the way through your book, and what I find incredible is people's ability to better themselves after terribly traumatic experiences. Because I think the assumption would be, and often a human reaction to deep-seated trauma and events can be, that one becomes harder and tougher and maybe more defensive and not as nice a person as they once were. But this book is proving that theory wrong, isn't it?
I think there's room for all those things that you just said. You know, in the initial stages, people who've experienced some life-altering trauma are trying to survive. They're just trying to get through that experience. And during that period, they could be very unpleasant to be around. You know, I was diagnosed with PTSD as a result of my work, particularly in forensic psychology. And I know my wife, now my ex-wife, you know, found that difficult to be around. And, you know, ex-Vietnam veterans, for example, can be very difficult to be around when they're still experiencing or exhibiting a lot of those symptoms. But what happens is there is a transformation process as somebody starts to gain insight into their own mental well-being and, you know, what behaviours support recovery and what behaviours don't, is that there becomes a transformation, and that transformation starts to blossom into a new kind of person, and it can well be the kind of person you were talking about, you know, more empathic, more kind, more compassionate person.
Is it the case, David, that the deeper the trauma, the longer the trauma, the bigger the event you've been through, the longer it takes you to recover from it? Or is it that every person is different in the recovery process? Because I would imagine there'd be many people who don't recover. They remain stuck in that defensive mode.
Yes, there's quite a few things you've just said which are really relevant. One is that idea that people can stay stuck in their suffering, and that certainly happens. And one of the things I wanted to inquire about is that what keeps people stuck in their suffering, and also therefore what helps people move through that suffering. So that's one big question in itself. In terms of the types of trauma and how long it goes for, that varies. So this is where individual differences can come into play. It seems to be that men, for example, are more likely to have a traumatic event because men tend to work in riskier occupations, or they tend to be just more risk-taking. But on the other hand, women tend to get more sustained trauma through things like domestic violence or sexual abuse. And when it's recurrent trauma and you're trapped in that and it happens again and again and again, that seems to be much harder to recover from and therefore eventually to grow from that. So the type of event can make a difference, but it really does depend a lot on the individual as well. And there's a lot of factors that go into that.
In terms of the way we get through the trauma we've experienced and the state of, I guess, fight or flight you might be in afterwards, is it that process of forgiveness, forgiving whoever or whatever impacted on you and forgiving yourself, that you then can move on? And is that why some people can't?
Forgiveness will play a part where somebody has done something to us. Where there hasn't been somebody that we can blame, and, you know, like the bushfire season could be an example of that, where you know, some people's homes are burnt and lost and others aren't. And there's no rhyme or reason to it. It's not like anyone's done that to you and that your home was particularly targeted. That type of event seems to be easier to get over, and there's no aspect of forgiveness. There's no sense of vengeance. There's nobody I want to get back to. But where somebody has done something to us, eventually we do need to form a relationship around that person and that person that may have done the bad thing to us. And, you know, an everyday example is, you know, where there's a marriage and one partner walks out on the other and maybe has an affair and all that sort of thing. And that's going to create a lot of hurt and anger. And that person that's walked out on you may, you know, never show any sense of remorse. They think they did the right thing and they don't think there's anything they need to be forgiving about. But the one that's left has still got to deal with this sense that, oh, you know, they did the wrong thing by me. So the idea is that we may not be able to have a reconciliation with the person that did the thing to us, but we may have a sense of forgiveness. And in the book, I think I give a really good example of that, an extreme example of that, where, you know, an African-American woman's son went to a party and there was another young man there and he shot her son over just a trivial argument and murdered her son. And for 10 years, she just had, you know, this strong thoughts of vengeance. But eventually she realized the vengeance was eating away at her and keeping her stuck in her suffering. And so she was a Christian woman and spoke with a pastor and said, how can I move out of this awful sense of vengeance? You know, I want to hurt him and he's in prison. And he said, well, whenever his name comes to you, just say, I forgive you, in the same way you would forgive a friend. And she did that for quite a while, and she noticed a softening in herself. And then she actually asked to go and see him in the prison. And he'd grown up by this stage because he was only about 18 or 20 or something when it happened. So he'd matured and had a lot of time to think. And they then spent 2 hours face-to-face in the prison meeting room discussing, you know, what the impact had been of those events and why they had happened. And at the end, they hugged. And they hugged because they realized that each had their own story. There was no true malice there. And now they live side by side. She's helped rehouse him. And they go around the country talking about the power of forgiveness.
That is an incredible story. I do remember reading that in the book, a mother to lose their child and then forgive the person who took that life away. That is an extraordinary story to recount. I know there's a part of the book, part about suffering, that you wanted to read. I think it's a little bit later in the book. Would you like to do that now?
Sure. I think, you know, with the current situation that we're all facing, and Victoria at the moment's particularly feeling it, is that we need to understand that with suffering, it's inevitable when our world gets turned upside down and things don't go the way that we thought they were going to do. We can't change that situation, but we can ease the suffering by just starting to rethink it in a different way, like reinventing ourselves. And I'll just read a bit about, towards the end of the book, the final chapter, some of the conclusions that I came to. And as you know, I spoke to a lot of different storytellers, so I'm just referring to them here as storytellers. What are the lessons and practices that we can embrace from our storytellers? What can we extract from the field of post-traumatic growth research, even if we haven't experienced trauma or the outer reaches of suffering as others have? All our storytellers changed the way they viewed themselves and their assumptions about the way life goes. This points to the benefit of a more fluid self, a pliable self, with an easier going relationship with the assumptive world. It's becoming less afraid of change. The external and the internal things will not always turn out how we expect, for some more so than for others. So it's fashioning a sense of self that accommodates the known world, with the expectation that this world will change and we will morph again. It's a self that accepts what is for now, but with a looser grip. A fixed self with fixed notions of how things should be is the formula for becoming stuck in suffering.
I don't know about the listeners tonight, but I certainly, you know, can relate to that. You'd like to believe things, when they're good, are going to stay that way, and that, but things change, and you have to be accepting that, that I guess trusting that you will evolve and adapt to that. And oftentimes people don't have that trust.
And I think one of the post-traumatic growth outcomes and the different ways people can grow is a sense of courage, developing a sense of courage. Like if you've been through one major life upheaval and you learn some things about yourself and how to survive that sort of thing and how to cope, and you get through that, when a next major upheaval happens, you think, well, I got through that one, so I can get through this one. And I know for myself and for all the storytellers in the book, it's like, well, you know, I got through that. What can life possibly throw at me that I can't deal with? Even if at that moment when it hits me, I don't know what to do, I will find a way through. And that personal courage is a very common thing that people say they develop after a major life crisis and after they survived it and grown from it.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to that. I hate to bring myself into it, but a few years ago my sister passed away, and I often remember the time, the dark times where you think you're never going to recover from this. You can't. I'm still recovering, but I do often think, good on me, I got through that, and, you know, I didn't think I could, and I did. So there is a really bizarre phenomenon that's come from that experience, and that I have, I guess, my self-confidence has grown since then. Mm. And I think lots of people would feel the same, that you feel proud in yourself that you got through something you never thought would happen to you in your life.
And I guess, you know, Laura, that goes to a more general thing, is that, you know, if we think back on our life experiences, however much life we've had so far, we can easily find those times when we struggled, and I'm not talking about trauma type struggle now, but just more everyday struggles, whether it's study or it's work or it's personal relationships, where we struggled and we got through that and we gained some wisdom. And in that wisdom, we just developed this confidence. So we learn most through struggle rather than everything going right for us all the time.
And you detail in the book, there are different types of trauma, aren't there? That you've spoken to a number of storytellers, and from what I've read so far, they've all had very different experiences.
When we use the word trauma, you know, as a psychologist, there's a clinical definition that psychologists and psychiatrists would use, and I'm using trauma in a broader sense. And the clinical definition of trauma is things like post-traumatic stress disorder, where someone has experienced a life-threatening event or violence to themselves or to somebody they care about. And so we're including that. And a lot of war veterans who develop PTSD also experience growth. And what's also important to note is that you can still have disturbances in your life. Like you talked about your sister dying, and I imagine you still feel grief about that, but you walk alongside mm-hmm. that grief. It's not like the grief completely envelops you. So we can still grow even though there's a part of our life that might be still grieving, and that's often true for veterans as well. So that's the clinical trauma. But then we have a trauma where it disrupts our worldview and our sense of self. In that reading, I was talking about that sense of self. And I like to talk about the storied self, the idea that, you know, when we're a baby, we've got no sense of self at all, but we start having life experiences and we start putting two and two together, and we get this idea, oh, I'm an actual person and I'm separate from other people. Oh, I'm this kind of person. You know, people talk to me or treat to me in a certain way, so I must be this kind of person. And, you know, wherever we grow up, we develop expectations about what life's going to hold for us. And when that gets disrupted, like it has, say, in the current situation with the pandemic, it really disrupts our storied self. So we have to make a new story. And we have to realize that our story itself is actually a construct. Our sense of self isn't a physical thing. It doesn't exist in the body. It doesn't exist in the brain. It's something that we've constructed over time. And what I was getting to in that reading is that we can morph our sense of self. We can create a new story. So that type of trauma is, you know, where it's more of a psychological disruption. The other type of trauma we talked about is moral, which you touched on with forgiveness, is moral injury, where somebody has done something we just find morally abhorrent, or maybe we've done something that later on we think is morally abhorrent. Once again, you know, war veterans who been in war situations where they maybe have shot a child and it turned out that that child was just a child. They weren't carrying a, you know, a bomb or anything like that. And they can feel incredible remorse and bad feelings about themselves. Moral injury also occurs with first responders like paramedics, where, you know, they see people doing things that they just find philosophically or morally very, very bad.
Well, this is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. And more with writer and psychologist David Rowland in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers now offer fully live streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is writer and psychologist David Rowland, whose new book, The Power of Suffering, is out now. I have read most of it. It is a very insightful book that you can learn a lot from. I think everyone can take something from it. Now, David, before the break, we were talking about in depth about your book, and I think the listeners, if they read it, will come to the understanding that you have been through a fair bit of trauma yourself. You had a stroke, you were in deep financial trouble, but you also worked in the prison system as well, which I can imagine would be traumatic for any staff member. But as a psychologist, we would have heard and seen a lot, wouldn't you?
Yes, and I think, you know, what story we bring to our work, you know, what our background is can change things. So I was very happy middle-class background. I hadn't really seen or met any really bad people. So it was probably even more shocking for me when I started my first position in a prison in New South Wales. And that particular prison was one where they held a lot of life sentence prisoners, people that were never to be released. So their crimes had been so bad, or the idea that they might rehabilitate was so poor that, you know, they were just going to stay in prison. And that's the first time I came across murderers. I came across my first psychopaths there. And I realized with one guy that, you know, who was definitely a psychopath who'd committed several murders and been released and then, you know, recommitted, was that there was no feeling of remorse. It was this sense of, you know, I've got no feelings for other human beings. And that was absolutely shocking to come across somebody that had no feelings for other people. I came across my first paedophiles there. And once again, I guess, you know, we were talking about moral injury before. What struck me about these paedophiles was that they didn't see anything wrong in their behaviour with children, even though they understood intellectually that society didn't approve of what they'd done. They thought that it was a benefit to the child and to them. So that's a pretty, you know, confronting view to have right in front of you. After my first prison, I moved on to Parkley Prison, which is in Sydney, because I was asked to run the drug and alcohol unit there, which was attempting to rehabilitate prisoners that had drug and alcohol problems. And it was in that year, which was in 1986, when the Anita Cobby murderers were brought into jail. And Anita Cobby was a nurse in her 20s. Who, you know, went home late one night after working in a hospital, and then was abducted from the railway station And then, you know, I don't even want to describe what happened to her, but she was dead by the next morning.
I've read the book about Anita Cobby. There was a number of young men involved, wasn't there? It was a shocking crime.
There were five, and three of them were brought into the protection unit, which is where the drug and alcohol unit was, and where I also had responsibility for some of the inmates. And I found that completely confronting. You know, like the prison officers were telling me, there was a lot of rumours about what had happened to her, and some of it was true and some of it not. But it was just really confronting to be facing these guys like fresh murderers. And they exhibited no obvious remorse. I mean, at that stage, they hadn't been convicted, so they probably weren't going to admit to anything anyway. But it was just very hard to be in the presence of what felt like evil. And I didn't realise what an impact that had had on me until 20 years later. You know, I was running a private practice, and some of these memories started to catch up with me. And that's when I thought maybe I'm suffering some sort of trauma. And I spoke to a more senior psychologist, and he said, I think you've got post-traumatic stress disorder and depression that goes with it.
It makes a lot of sense given all of the terrible detail you would have heard about so many people's stories over the years. Any human would take that on board, and you've heard more than most. You were a young boy born in Sydney, weren't you? And you grew up in quite a pretty place with bush and ocean around you. It sounds like quite the idyllic childhood.
Yes, I was 6 months old, born in Sydney, but my parents moved to this coastal hamlet between Sydney and Wollongong, right by a beautiful beach. But we had virgin bushland across the road. It was, you know, even the road was not sealed, so it was a dirt road. And our playground was just the bush and the cliffs and the ocean down the bottom. I think I developed my love of just being outdoors and being in the Australian bush from that time. Parents were irresponsible. They would just let their kids out to play and just make sure they came back by dinner time.
I remember doing that. Go down the creek and make sure you came home when the cockies were screeching as the sun was going down. Sadly, though, that's something that a lot of kids are missing out on at the moment because of coronavirus, especially here in Victoria. You know, we can't even go to the man-made park, let alone where nature is at its best, the bush.
You know, in situations like this where you're unable to experience nature firsthand, and I think nature firsthand is actually something we all really need. But, you know, it's something that I've found useful is to listen to playlists of nature sounds, you know, whether it's rain or it's birds, and, you know, be transported into a more natural environment or watch videos where, you know, there's a lot of nature scenes. And I think, you know, we know neurologically that the brain, when it can imagine something to be, that feels real. The body responds to that as if it's real. So if you can imagine, you know, we all have very vivid dreams sometimes, and we get all the reactions from those dreams as if they were real. It's the same with mental imagery that you know, if we imagine we're in a beautiful place, we feel all the effects, physiological and emotional effects, of being in that beautiful place. So we can still transport ourselves mentally to these places.
Yeah, that gives a lot of credit toward meditation and all those sorts of things that are very powerful tools at the moment when we can't leave our homes.
There's, you know, neurological explanations for why things like meditation and using mental imagery and self-compassion practices really are very soothing for us. It's not a dark art at all.
Yeah, that's right. You were the eldest of the family, weren't you? Two brothers and a sister. And your mother played a great role in your life in terms of being an inspiration.
Yes, I like to talk about my mother. Not that I get much opportunity to do that. And I'm glad you asked about her. I only really realised how much of an inspiration and role model she was for me later on, you know, in my professional years. But she was an only child, and she grew up in England in the south of the country. And her parents fought a lot, I mean, as in verbal fighting, because her dad had been in the First World War, And he probably suffered from post-traumatic stress, we would say now. And he was drinking quite a bit, I think, probably to cope with that. But he was a happy drunk. And Mum actually had a really lovely relationship with him because she had a more emotional attachment to him, whereas her mother was a little bit more cold and controlling. And her dad, my grandfather, who unfortunately I never got to meet because he died in his 50s, was a bank teller, and he got hit by a car and got a head injury. And so he was at home, and this female doctor would come and do home visits. And that really impressed my mother. She just loved the way this woman cared for her father. And she had cousins who lived on a farm. And she'd love to visit them because of the animals. Whenever an animal would die, she would want to dissect it. So she was just curious about, you know, human life and animal life. And totally against her mother's wishes, she went on to study medicine at a time when very few girls went on into any profession at all. And then she was determined to have four children because she'd been an only child. And she met my father after the war because he was a pilot with the Royal Australian Air Force, and he went back to England to do some study and work. And they came out to Australia, and she, quick smart, had four children. And she was a local GP in our town when we were small. And so, you know, we would go on home visits, and we'd be sitting in the car while she went in to check on a patient. And there were some wonderful stories of some of that. She loved the characters in this town where we lived. But I loved her caring, and I loved her one single-mindedness. And, you know, I think, you know, going to the health field is totally due to her.
Is she where your passion for psychology came from?
Yes, I would say so. But my father was also very psychologically minded. He wasn't what we would think of as a stereotypical male. He was quite psychological. He would have someone you'd have deep philosophical discussions with. And in some ways, I found him easier to talk to about those sorts of things than my mother. But professional things, I would talk with my mother about.
Did she get to see your career progress at all?
She did, yes. I published my first book, The Confident Performer, which was about managing performance anxiety for musicians and singers and so on. And, you know, I got my PhD from that, and she got to know about that. But she actually died well before my father. Dad was always physically the one we thought would go first, but he well outlived her. Mm. And she was getting up to go to work one morning. She was 73 and she was still working part-time because she loved her work. At that stage, she was a psychiatrist. And she just collapsed in her bedroom and she got an aneurysm. So she died very quickly.
I'm sorry to hear that. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Plenty more after the break.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Because I understood that neuroplasticity was a thing that worked, and it was a matter of focusing your attention in certain ways and it would change the way the brain worked, I looked at other ways of improving my brain function. I discovered that dancing was one of the best physical activities you could do to improve brain health. So dancing incorporates motor activity, incorporates planning, it incorporates being in touch with your emotions. When you're partner dancing, you also have to synchronize with the other person, and being in tune with another person is actually very healing and very uplifting. So dancing became one of my go-to physical activities for getting well.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. That audio is our guest tonight, David Rowland, who is a psychologist and author, and it's from his mini documentary, Dancing for Joy, From Stroke to Salsa, and is, of course, courtesy of the Compassion in Action YouTube channel. Now, David, you wrote about that journey in the book, How I Rescued My Brain. Fascinating that dancing can be a part of recovery. recovery for your brain.
Yes, and I'll just say that that particular part of the story about dancing for brain health wasn't in How I Rescued My Brain. So for anyone that's read the memoir, How I Rescued My Brain, this is the sequel. The dancing is the sequel.
I was going to say.
And I'm still dancing.
How far have we... Are you?
Yes, yes, I love my dancing. I went to Zouk last night, which is a Brazilian dance, and Tuesday nights I go to Cuban salsa.
That's awesome. I've watched that video of you dancing. You're very good. You've got the moves, that's for sure. How far have we come, David, in our knowledge of brain plasticity, if that's how you say it? I'm not a psychologist by any stretch. Do you need to write a revised edition? Have we learnt more since you wrote that book?
I think the human brain is probably one of the most complex things in the known universe. Scientists will typically say that. So it's not like that we're going to understand it, you know, soon. I follow a few organisations like the Queensland Brain Institute and see what the latest things are happening. And neuroplasticity is very real. And what's interesting these days, what's developed more since I wrote How I Rescued My Brain, is electrical ways of stimulating particular areas of the brain, and also technology that can start to look at sort of just a few neurons rather than a big area of the brain and see what's happening in a few neurons rather than, you know, a big area. So, you know, like, for example, with choirs, if you sing in a choir, what's interesting is that people's brainwave patterns start to synchronize. And any musician knows that when they start to play with other musicians, in the beginning, it feels like you're a bit out of sync, unless you play with them all the time. But then you get into a groove. I'll use terms like getting into a groove. And that what's happening then is that everybody's brainwave patterns are starting to synchronize, like they will look the same. So we know that there's various activities that will change brain functioning. And it's becoming more apparent that things like dancing, for example, are really good for a lot of neurological disorders. And that's where I, you know, first took up dancing for purely for brain health. And then also also to release trauma from the body. You know, trauma is held in the body. And there's another type of dance called five rhythms, which takes you through five different rhythms over a two-hour class. And I wasn't expecting this. A friend said, you should go and do five rhythms. This is when I first started dancing. And it's just totally expressive dancing where you let your feet move you rather than your head decide what moves you do. So it's from the feet up. And I found this energy just sort of unwinding out of me. And after a while of doing these classes, I realized it was all the despair and grief and trauma just being released from my body. And it's well known now that the body holds trauma, and it's in a nonverbal way. So dancing could be one of those forms. So the exciting thing is that there's much more to be learned about the human brain.
I can imagine. Where are you now on your journey of brain recovery?
I think I'm doing as much as I possibly can. I'm involved with the Stroke Foundation. They've got what they call the Young Stroke Project right now, and I'm on an advisory committee for that. And we're looking at resources that people who have what we call young strokes would need to access. So you can be a young stroke anywhere under age 65. So typically, you know, people with younger strokes have families and they have a lot of responsibilities. So I'm helping out with that particular project, so giving back in that way. The main symptom I still have from my stroke is mental fatigue. So if I concentrate for a long time or I'm in a very noisy room or a very noisy place where there's a lot of sensory stimulation, I can get a mental fatigue. It's like a extreme form of tiredness, and mental fatigue is still not understood what it is and why it should be that people with brain injuries or even people, you know, with chemo brain, you know, people that are going through cancer treatment, they can get what's called chemo brain, which is a bit like having a brain injury. You just become super sensitive to sensory inputs and you can feel this mental fatigue. So that's the one area I haven't sorted out yet, but, you know, that no one else has either.
Your stroke was initially misdiagnosed for a few weeks, wasn't it? What have you learnt from that, and have you got any advice for people who might not recognise the signs of stroke if they've had one?
I was what they sometimes call a walk and talk stroke. So I didn't get, typically a stroke you'll see drooping of the face. You might, it's one side, so drooping of the face or the mouth. Maybe one arm is limp. The person may have some difficulty speaking or not be able to speak at all, or their speech is slurred. And if you ever see those signs, you should just get an ambulance straight away, because if you can get a stroke early, there is medications that will help remediate the effects, because you've got millions of brain cells dying per minute when that's happening.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au, and more with David Rowland when we return.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers now offer fully live-streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is writer and psychologist David Rowland, whose new book, The Power of Suffering, is out now. And it's a wonderful read. There's a lot to learn from that book. I think we've all been through something in our lives, haven't we, David? What, in terms of our lives, what does the rest of 2020, the year that we're all lamenting at the moment, what does it hold for you?
I'm probably no different than many in the sense that 2020 has upended all the plans I had. You know, my book came out just at the start of the lockdown, so I managed to get in a book release and an event in the bookshop. And I had all these events planned and all this publicity planned, and it all disappeared. And, of course, all the news is around the virus. So, you know, I've had to take my own lessons. And what's interesting for me about that, even though I know so much about post-traumatic growth now, and I've been through struggles and I know I will get through these struggles, I still felt the effects of the struggle. I still at times felt despair. I thought, well, here's this book, here's this plan of events that I had for the rest of the year, and it hasn't worked out. And if anyone's listening and they think, oh, he's an expert, but he still experienced despair, he still experienced disruption, that just tells you that that's the normal human experience, and that we should be experiencing these things if things have really changed for us. But what I know is that the unexpected produces the unexpected. So given that, you know, we didn't expect any of these things that have happened in 2020, what I know from past experiences and from my storytellers is that new possibilities will open up, new people will enter your life that you never expected, you'll develop in ways that you didn't think it was possible. Like, I never thought I would be dancing, and I went to Cuba last year. I never thought I would go to Cuba and go dancing. You know, people have come into my life that I absolutely treasure, which wouldn't have happened if I hadn't gone through the things that I went through. The deeper relationships that I have now wouldn't have existed if I hadn't gone through the things. So I really like all the effects of the disruption that I've had, but I wouldn't particularly like to go through that again. You know, because it's not very pleasant. The message is that disruption will happen. It will feel awful while it's happening, but the hope is real when you believe that it will pass and good things will happen again.
That is a wonderful message to end our chat with. Thank you, David Rowland. Thank you for being with us tonight. And, of course, those listening, The Power of Suffering, his new book, is out now. Have a read. There's a lot to learn from it. Thank you for being with us, David.
Thank you, Laura. It's been lovely to chat with you.
And if you've enjoyed our chat with David Rowland tonight and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And of course, join me the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.